When I was a lot younger, I do have to confess that I have never been a scout, but I spent a lot of time abseiling and caving and canyoning. In fact, I lived in New South Wales. I actually lived in Stradbroke, for those people in Stradbroke. Went up there when I was too young to remember. New South Wales, Blue Mountains are full of great places. We used to buy rope in 200-metre lengths and find the longest drop we could go off. But I won't spend the time telling you those stories. For those who don't know, I've got some pictures of us abseiling, canyoning and caving. They're all on one side. I could tell you stories about each one of those. The one on the right there is Clostral Canyon. If you ever get the opportunity to do Clostral Canyon in New South Wales, make sure you go with someone who knows what they're doing. I actually rescued the SCAT team, which is a special casualty access team, out of that canyon, and they were very embarrassed. But you abseil through a hole the size of a truck tyre. That's the picture there. There's three abseils in a row, the 80-metre walls on either side, and at the bottom of the third one, you can touch them with your elbows. A whole valley of the Blue Mountains drains through that hole. If five guys up the river have a leak, you drown. Okay, so it's really important that you go in good weather. When I was at Bible College, I used to take a group of Army Reserve guys, I think I've got a picture of some of those guys, and train them in abseiling and canyoning. It was a great way to earn money, and I used to take groups caving as well. And one of the things I learnt when I was caving is that you must be prepared. I would take this backpack underground that was full of gear that I'm pleased to say, never used. There was foam mattresses for when people would injure themselves so they didn't get hypothermia. There's pulleys and blocks and tackles that I could rig to pull people out of crevices and holes. There was blocks of chocolate. I do confess to eating that. That's probably fairly obvious. First aid equipment, which remained unused, which is good. Candles, spare gloves, spare... In fact, I worked out that if you wanted to get out a group of people out of underground safely, then you need to be prepared before you went under. Sometimes we went through narrow squeezes. I think I've got a fair sight. I can show it. Now, that's not the pack I took. That's just the first aid kit, okay? So it gives you an idea where you go through. You need to take all that extra gear, because if you actually want to get out alive with a group of people you're taking through, or uninjured, and it doesn't take long to die on the ground, especially those... I won't say that, will I? Those people are... So you need to be prepared. As I said, I've never been part of the scouting movement, but I know that you guys take that whole concept of being prepared really seriously, don't you? But I take something seriously about being prepared as a Christian. I want to be prepared for one day I will meet Jesus face to face. And if we're only prepared for this part of life, then it's like being entering a marathon and not being prepared to finish it. I want to get there at the end in a state that makes me able to enjoy it. Well, this morning we actually read something in the Bible about some people who lived 2016 years ago. There were people who liked Jesus and they followed Jesus, and there were people who hated Jesus' guts and they put him on a cross and put him to death because they didn't like what he said. They didn't like who he claimed to be, and they didn't think they needed what he offered. And we read in our Bible, we've been reading in our church on Sunday mornings through this book of John for a while, and today we read that as Jesus has been put in the tomb, we saw that last week if you were here last week, today we read that these guys come to the tomb wanting to bury Jesus' body properly. They were pretty sad. And when they get to where Jesus was buried, they expected him to be dead. But when they got there, the tomb was open and the body's gone. But what we read today is that not only did they find an empty tomb, for that doesn't prove anything, they meet the risen Jesus. And that proves an awful lot. So if Jesus is alive, I want you to be prepared for the time that you will meet him face to face. Now that should raise a whole pile of questions in your thinking. if Jesus is really alive? You want to ask that question because if it actually happened, then you need to know what actually happened and whether what Christians claim happened really did happen. I've got two questions we're going to look at. How do we know he was really alive is the first one. You see, Christians will always claim Jesus was alive. And the reason why they'll claim that is, well, people might think that we're biased. We've got a vested interest in claiming that Jesus was alive. In fact, in the Bible it says that if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, everything Christians stand for is a dead set waste of time. So we want to make sure not only that Jesus was alive, but we need to go back one step further and make sure he was really dead in the first place. And there's heaps of evidence that helps us answer that question. It's a big topic, and I'm not going to go into it now because we might be here until tomorrow. Or it might be still World Scout Day before we finished, actually. But anyhow, Jewish people and Roman people who didn't like Jesus at all actually wrote about this. So you can read the historical documents. You can be prepared by looking at history and see what did they say about Jesus. And the people who wrote actually wrote about Jesus' death. They write about Jesus being crucified. In fact, a guy who lives today who's an expert in the field, you won't know him, but lots of people I don't know and you don't know, he actually was, he's very critical of Christianity, but he says this about the death of Jesus. That he was crucified is as sure as anything historical can be. So there's a historian alive today that when he looks at the records is absolutely blown away with the evidence that tells us that Jesus was really dead. But it needs to be more than that, doesn't it? You might have evidence, you might have arguments and counter-arguments, and we're not going to go into all of those today, but if you really want to actually engage this topic, there are answers. I encourage you to chase them down. We can be sure Jesus was dead, but how can we be sure he really came back to life? Well, again, I could overwhelm you with evidence and we could still be here on World Scout Day next year. But we don't want to be like that, and I'm sure the tea and coffee will go cold. That'd be terrible. You know, there's two people we can look at that we know lots about who actually didn't believe all this Jesus is the Son of God stuff. In fact, they were pretty opposed to it, and one of them was Jesus' own brother, a bloke called James. Now, if you've ever read your Bible, you read about James in the Bible. But I tell you what, James was alive before he started writing what was in the Bible. And when he was a brother of Jesus, he wasn't a great fan of Jesus. In fact, when he met the risen Jesus, after Jesus died and after he's risen, okay, James goes from being someone who's a skeptic, that's someone who doesn't really believe that Jesus is who he claims to being someone who's actually a leader in the church. It's a pretty radical transformation, and that's why we can read about him in the Bible, because he wrote some of the stuff that's in the Bible. You see, James went from being a skeptic to a leader. He was so committed to the reality that Jesus had risen from the dead that James was prepared to die for that fact. He didn't die for a rumour that someone said. He didn't die for something that he hoped was true. He died for something he'd seen with his own eyes. There's another bloke in the Bible who you might have heard about who actually, we know some of his story before he was a follower of Jesus, and his name is Paul. You might know him as the name Paul or the name Saul. He's got the use of people often had different names or different names in different languages, actually, in those days. And Paul was so opposed to Jesus and people who were silly enough to follow Jesus that Paul rounded them up and killed them. That's how serious he was about it. And he used to live in a place, actually he was on his way to a place called Damascus. I've got a photo of Straight Street in Damascus. You know, Straight Street is mentioned in the Bible. It's the longest, they believe, the longest continually named street anywhere in the world. Now, I don't know what's happened in Damascus exactly in the last couple of years, but that's a photo. That's not me. I actually know a bloke who used to live in that street. That's pretty amazing. Not Jesus, I'm not talking about anyone like that. I'm talking about, I met him 3 weeks ago. He used to live in Straight Street. Okay, I don't know him well. He was speaking at a conference I was at. Anyhow, Straight Street. Paul went from being a person who used to kill Christians to being a person who would do anything to tell people about Jesus. He went to being a proclaimer. And the thing that made the difference for Paul is not because he saw an empty tomb, but because Paul met the risen Jesus face to face. That's pretty amazing stuff. And that's just a little taste of the evidence that you can know for certain that Jesus really did die and he really did rise again. And the reason why you need to know this stuff, or to at least think through this stuff, is remember what I want you to be? I want you to be prepared to meet the risen Jesus. If that stuff that we read in the Bible's true, which I think it is, and you need to work it out if you don't think it is, you actually need to be prepared to meet the risen Jesus. There's tons of evidence. There's plenty of opportunities. If he is alive, how can you prepare to meet him one day? That's my second question. It might seem a long way off, but it doesn't take much looking at the news each night to know that we don't always know when we're going to be standing before Jesus. It's worthwhile being prepared. I never had an accident that resulted in me needing to get out my rescue equipment underground or in a canyon, but I always took the gear with me because I never knew when I'd need it. You know, sadly, I meet many people who think that they'll be right before God, that they're prepared to meet God, if they're just good people. Now, I know myself, I don't know lots of you guys, I do know some of you, and I can tell you you're not good. Because how good do you actually need to be right to stand before God? Because I know myself, if I had to be good enough, I'd know that I'd never make it. Because there's things I've done that I can't even remember doing that would put me in trouble before God. But there's plenty of things I've done that I would remember doing, and I know I'm not good enough. You don't need to know the details. But you know what? When you read the Bible, you see that good enough for God is actually not being 80% good enough. It's actually being 100% good enough. And I know scouts guys, and I know normal people in the world take living good well. And they work hard at living good, but not one person I've ever met has pulled it off 100%. I'm just going to do a quick survey here. Is anyone here 100% perfect? I'll put my hand here. Good. I'll check with your parents. And if you are a parent, I'll check with your parents. In fact, I've been told that if you ever meet someone who claims to be 100% good, all you need to do is go and stamp on their foot. And you'll very quickly find out they're not as good as they think they are. You see, there's a verse in the Bible that says, we can never be good enough for God. So how can I get to the point that I can be confident that I can stand before God one day, that I'm prepared to stand before God? There's a great verse in the Bible that tells us about that confidence. It comes from Ephesians, a book of the New Testament that the bloke Paul wrote to a church in a place called Ephesus. And he reminds them just how wonderful it is what Jesus did on the cross. These words of this verse say, "For it is by grace you have been saved through faith. And this is not of yourselves, but a gift from God. Not by works, so that no one can boast." You know, people got awards today and they had to do something for those awards. That's normal. I've got awards that I had to do stuff for. I got elected once for the Senior Citizen of the Year Award and I was most upset about that. But that was in Lightning Ridge and that's a longer story. You know what? You had to do something to get the award. But you know what? When God offers us a gift is something that's free. And all you need to do when you're offered a gift is to accept it. Unbelievable. Well, it's not unbelievable. The gift of being right with God, that you can be prepared to meet God face to face well, is given to you and to me, a gift we don't deserve. It's called grace. Sometimes people think grace is something you have to say when you bow your head and close your eyes and put your hands together. That's right, that's grace before a meal. That's just thanking God for the food. But grace in the Bible is all about God giving us a gift that we didn't deserve. It's incredible. It says, not by works, so that no one can boast about it. I'm not a better Christian than any other Christian. I'm just as much in need of God's gift as anyone else. And the message of the Bible is this, that we can be right to stand before God. We can be prepared
to stand before God because Jesus stood in our place. He graciously offered us the gift of forgiveness.
How does that relate back to the empty tomb? You know, if I claimed to be the Son of God, you'd all have a smirk on your face, and rightly so, might I say. But you know what? If you got so frustrated with me that one day you got out your 12 gauge, don't do this, please, and shot me, and 3 days later I came and knocked on your front door and said, listen, I am the Son of God, my bet is that you'd start listening to me from then on in. Now, I'm not going to do that, and I'd rather you didn't try that out on me. But Jesus actually said he was God's son. People didn't like what he said. They put him on a cross, and 3 days later, he was there so they could actually, we could read here, that they could actually touch him. And if you read a little bit more in John's gospel, he actually said, why don't you put your finger in the holes if you really don't believe it? What does trust look like? There's a bloke called Blondin. I don't know whether you've ever come across Blondin. Blondin lived when I was a very, very, no, I wasn't even born, 1859. That's a long time ago. This building, the back bit that you're sitting in, was built in 1886. So Blondin lived before the back part of this church was even thought of, okay? Where's Adelaide? 1836, okay? So about the time Adelaide, just after Adelaide was settled, this bloke called Blondin, he was around at that stage. In 1859, he walked across the Niagara Falls. Pretty amazing. And we've got not a picture of him there. They didn't have great photos. And there's a bit of an artist drawing. There's a newspaper article from it of when he did it. He was probably the world's best tightrope walker. He trusted that rope he was on. In fact, over his lifetime, he walked back and forward across there, they reckon, over 300 times. Pretty amazing. As he walked one day, he got to the other side and the reporters were there. I think it was one of the first times because it talks about it on that little article on the right-hand side. And he gets to the other side and they're all saying, you're the best that's ever been, Blondin. And we think that you're the greatest tightrope walker that's ever been. And he says, well, do you reckon I could do it with a wheelbarrow? Yeah. And they said, who wants to hop in the wheelbarrow? No one wanted to hop in the wheelbarrow. Understandable. They reckon his manager, a bloke called Henry Colquhoun, actually hopped in. Pretty silly. No. Anyhow, see, trust is not when you just say you can do it. Trust is actually when you hop in the wheelbarrow. That's the bloke who trusted him, wasn't it? That's the bloke who trusted Blondin. Trust is not a verbal thing. It's actually an action thing. When I taught people to abseil, it's easy to tell them what the ropes do and how strong they are. They can look at how many trees they're tied off to. But it's not till you get on the rope and go over the edge, you're actually putting your trust in the rope. You can know it all in your head, but it's not till you go over the edge that it actually is trust. It's not till you hop in the wheelbarrow you're actually trusting Blondin. And it's not until you put your trust in Jesus, when you put your trust in him for your salvation, you receive his gift of forgiveness, and you seek, because he's forgiven you, to live life in a way that honours him. It's not until then that you're actually trusting. See, trust is not a verbal thing. It's more than knowledge just stored up in your head. It's a life changed. If you're into English, trust is a verb. It's a doing word. Okay? It's an action. There's plenty more I could say. But if you want to know more, can I suggest you, there's a couple of ways you can easily know more. You need to talk to someone. If you've never been part of a church, or if you're part of a church and they've never really talked about what Christianity is about, then ask questions. See, I told you there was evidence. There's tons of evidence. It's just a matter of asking about it. But it's more than knowledge, remember, if you're serious about it. It's actually then having a life changed by what you find out. You can ask questions, you can send emails. We actually have a Christianity Explored. If you want to explore Christianity, you can find out about it in this church over about 4 weeks, although sometimes if you've got lots of questions, it will blow out. So let me warn you of that. We have a kids club where you can find out more. I think Kim was talking about Scouts, but let me talk about kids club. There's more you can find out about this stuff that we're talking about now. And on a Sunday morning, obviously, we meet here at 10 o'clock. And 6 o'clock if you like an evening service, or 8:30 if you want me to get dressed up in a dress. Can I encourage you to be people who read the Bible? We've actually got, over on that table over there, a pile of Bibles. They're freebies, okay? There's a thin one, And there's a small one. The small one's just got a picture that looks for youth. That's a good one if you want to, your kids want to grab one. If you run out, I've got plenty more. I just never have room to put them out. And if you want to grab your own Bible, you don't have one to read, then grab one of the Bibles off over there. Don't pinch the ones in the pews there because they are fairly hard for me to get back again. But those ones I've got plenty of to give away. And you'd be more than welcome to take a book and read through the Bible and find out more. We've been reading in John's Gospel. You could find out about that. It's got a table of contents. The shortest book in the Bible about Jesus is Mark's Gospel. So if you like the short ones, go for that. How about I pray? Lord, we thank you that when it comes to trusting in the risen Jesus, you did not leave us without tons and tons of evidence. But more important than the evidence, Lord, we thank you that when Jesus died on the cross, he paid the debt of our sin and enabled us to have our friendship with God restored. Lord, help us to take you seriously. Help us to trust you. And we ask this, Lord, in your name. Amen.